Well, welcome to episode 2 of Mining Web Weekly with Peter Major. He is the Director of Mining for Modern Corporate Solutions. Well, I would call you an immediate hit, Mr. Major. Not to say that people don't love you. When it comes to mining, I'm pretty sure after all these years of talking sense that you've got a legion of fans, and we certainly saw that with those who turned up in numbers and stayed for a long time in our conversations. But mining is it's kind of active now. We seem to have kicked off the Mining Web Weekly at just about the right time.
I think we have, Alec, and maybe half to two thirds of those listeners, those viewers, maybe they're just here because they want to kill me or give me the middle finger. I'm not sure if they're all positive fans or negative fans, but we're talking about things that affect a lot of people. And I try and come up with a worldview, but just sitting in South Africa, it's a little tougher to get a worldview than if you're sitting somewhere else for a little bit, just checking the headlines, the people you're talking to. But I can definitely say the turnaround for mining from Major's perspective was COVID. And it was a good thing I was a Catholic, because I was really looking for suicide the first few months of COVID. We'd battled so much on the mining front in South Africa. We battled so much on Modern Corporate Solutions. And we all know what happened when COVID really hit in March, April 2020. It looked like the world was really going to come to an end as we know it. Our mining business was definitely coming to an end. So I thought I might as well go to an end. Less than 3 months later, the markets bottomed, and we thought it was a bounce. And metal prices were shooting up. We thought that was a bounce. It's not a bounce. The world stock markets have continued to go since that time. What is that? That's more than 5 years ago, And metal prices, pretty much the same story. Yes, the PGMs came off those crazy, insane heights. And we know they're cyclical. So when they come down, they don't stop at the mean. They go through the mean on the way down. But they're all back above their mean now. Gold, it just continued to fly. So world stock markets have gone up. Most metal prices are above their mean or way above their mean. And I'm getting calls. We started getting calls at Modern Corporate Solutions within 3 months of COVID. By 4 months, people that had turned us down on a lot of the mining projects were saying, have you still got those available? We're as negative on South Africa as ever, but we are more positive on metals, and we need metals. We need projects. If that means we got to come at least visit South Africa, so be it. So that's been going on continuously. And just the time I've been in the States here, which is the last 4 months, the last 3 weeks, I've gotten more calls, more visits, CEOs, geologists, financiers. I've got more calls the last 3 weeks than the previous 3 months. So it's picking up. You see, with Mr. Trump as president, we're getting more and more minerals put on the critical minerals list. And boy, that guy's writing checks. Thank heavens. He's spending $2 trillion more this year than he's bringing in. So thank heavens he's writing some checks for mining.
Sure. Well, maybe we can start there, because he has added copper, silver, and potash to the critical minerals list. Just explain what that list is all about.
Yeah, I often think Mr. Trump has aspects similar to Mr. Zuma that he remembers most the last person he met. He acts most on the last person he met of the day. And we know America runs on lobbyists. When you got a city like Washington, D.C., that supposedly has 50,000 registered lobbyists, well, you can bet there's another 50,000 that aren't registered that are running around doing the same thing. So can you imagine 500 members of Congress, 50,000 lobbyists? So what is that? 100 per congressman. So each congressman has 100 people trying to tell him what he should be doing for the good of the country. So how much of these critical minerals is the mining industry lobbying? I've never heard of fewer lobbyists in an industry than mining, Alec. They complain a lot. The CEOs always complain we're not being heard. in Washington, in Pretoria, in London. I think they are being heard. Department of Defense, I know for a fact the Department of Defense is really worried about getting the minerals, especially rare earths and similar minerals for the drones, because they see this is how the world is going. You know, Ukraine fighting Russia has a lot of similarities to the Boer War. This was the first televised worldwide coverage like never before. When the Boer War hit, all the countries wanted to see how strong is Britain, what material inventions, et cetera, are the British going to use, what tactics are they going to use. And the Boer, he knew the country and he had to adapt very quickly. He didn't have 10% of the budget, the men, the equipment. So Thomas Edison was down there with a film crew, you know. America, Germany, Austria, all the big powers then, they were sending teams of people down here following the battles, following the fights. That's now going on with Russia and China. So when I say I know for a fact, it doesn't just mean I'm reading the headlines on Bloomberg's, reading the paper, talking to local miners here. Yeah, we got $50 million from the Department of Defense to open up Sunshine because of the antimony. Forget the rich silver it's got. I've got South Africans telling me companies they're involved in here are getting amazing tenders from Department of Defense. So, yeah, minerals are coming not to the fore, but geez, their visibility and familiarity with the average guy in the street and definitely with government, it's probably higher now than the last 20 years. Probably ever. It's probably higher now ever than since World War II in America.
That's interesting background in those parallels with the Boer War and the Ukraine War. But what about this critical minerals list? Why would Trump have decided to put copper, silver, and potash onto it?
Look, without a doubt, the world has to have copper. AI has to have copper. AI is going to consume energy. I don't know offhand. I read it so much, I can't remember which number I want to remember. That it consumes enormous amount of electricity, and governments have to watch how much they let this electricity we're currently generating go to AI. Because if you look at the shares and the money flow on the stock market, anything AI is getting all the money at once, probably multiples of what it deserves or needs. This is really like the dot-com boom of 20 says, you know, you had boo.com and things getting $1 billion in a week. So if these AI companies are just getting money thrown at them, the price of electricity doesn't matter for them. They could pay 50 to 100% more and they'll get it. Well, if you're an electrical company, generation company, you want to sell where you get the most money. But what's that going to do to the masses? If the masses, they're complaining now about paying 7-8% more when inflation here is supposedly 3%, Alec. Well, boy, it won't be long before they'll storm the White House and burn the place down if the masses are having to start paying double-digit increases. So they're going to build electrical plants. And silver, it's actually got superior electricity conductivity to even copper. And copper actually even beats gold. But silver can beat it. U.S. Department of Defense, they had to use a lot of silver because copper was more valuable for things other than creating an atom bomb in World War II. So the U.S. Department of Defense tapped into the U.S. Treasury and they drained a lot of silver for the industrial use. Now, we know solar panels use silver. Certain electrical applications use it. But is it really that critical? Copper's critical, yes. But it's always been critical. I just noticed last time I checked, it was this morning, I think we had 82 minerals in America on the critical mineral list. Well, hell, there's only about 115, I think, on the chemical spectrum. So we're going to get them all before we know it. They're all critical.
And potash, and I ask that because an old pal of mine, Sven Forsman, has been banging a drum about a company listed on the JSE called Core Potash. I don't know if you know about Core Potash, but Sven says it's the next best thing. And coming onto the critical minerals list, is it going to help Core Potash?
Yeah, it is going to help it. It's an amazing deposit. It's not in the most attractive part of the world. It's up there around the DRC. It's a big project. I see it every year at the Indabas. Ore body's great, and it's pretty close to the coast. And if this deposit was in North America, it would have been developed a long time ago. So typical story, you got a team of corporate financiers, project developers, they keep having another feasibility study and another, you know, trying to narrow down what it's really going to cost to get it going. Can we start it off on a smaller plan than we originally had? But it's, you need big money to do most of these projects. And it's hard to get them in Africa. Other than gold, it's still hard. Well, I should say other than copper and gold. So potash, does world really need it? The Americans need it because they fertilize their crops like nobody's ever known. A friend of mine this week was telling me, Pete, you don't have a clue how much fertilizer America's using. It takes five layers, five sprays to get a potato to grow. So you brag you're from Idaho, we just plant potatoes because the soil is just right. He says potatoes actually have more toxic chemicals on them than a plant like corn that sticks up, because a potato's underground. So you spray the dirt, you spray the leaves when it starts growing, and then you churn it with the plows. You know, you got to prepare the dirt. So you spray that before you even put the potatoes in. So unfortunately, a lot of the world, especially North America, is addicted to potash in big amounts and a lot of other things. So the world will keep growing. That's Anglo-American's star project, right? And it's a variation of potash in the UK. And Alec, if you want to review an incredible mining project, I would love to visit that. You know, they're sinking a very large, very deep shaft in a high density area. They're running a tunnel, I think 15, 20 kilometers under and bringing it up, and they still forecast profit margins, you know, 30, 40%. And it's because a lot of the world's used to using that material to grow crops. And yeah, we got to feed the masses. So potash, but should it be on a critical minerals list? You know, is a producer going to withhold it if he doesn't get the political action, the geopolitical action he wants? I don't know, but that's the talk of it. Critical minerals in the States, big $2 trillion deficit to fund anything that anybody has a wet dream about. So I'm not going to argue if minerals get on that list.
Core potash as well. Well, you mentioned electricity, and one of the biggest stories to come through this week is that the Mozambican lobbyists are now starting to get involved with the South 32 project. And it's you'd know a lot more about it. There's an aluminium smelter in Mozambique. Apparently 37,000 jobs are at risk if South 32 closes it down. South 32 gets the electricity from the Cabora Bassa Dam, but that comes through Eskom, which is, it says, is charging it too much. What's the story with all of this? Have you been following it?
Yeah, more from a mining viewpoint than probably a larger overall viewpoint. First of all, the jobs. Aluminum smelters are pretty efficient on jobs. They don't create that many directly. But we know in Africa, you have a lot more indirect jobs than you do in a first world country. That each employee there probably has 9 or 10 dependents, whether they're all his direct children or not. There's no doubt the average African has probably double the dependents, if not triple, what someone does. And that project was made when electricity was in abundance and it was cheap. And aluminum smelters consume a lot of electricity, and they're very related to the electricity price, because unless the price of aluminum goes up, and it had flashes when it went up, and really for no reason that was sustainable. So, but I hear what the CEO says. A smelter is not too unlike a mine. When you close it, it is hard to open. Now, technically, you can't open it up, but it costs money. And there's other down the road implications, you know, your suppliers, your chain of logistics. And I think some of his threats look a little over the top, but damn it, it seems you have to get over the top because people don't want to listen to reason. They don't want to listen to a sane person. They seem to be listening to the most outlandish people or lobbyists going. So the fact is, if this smelter closes, it's going to take a lot of money and effort to get it open. And if you're a listed company, you have to answer to shareholders. You have to answer to investors because there's a lot of good investments out there. And if they're generating easy to see, easy to get, double digit returns, and you're plugging around getting average returns, you know, 9 or 10% when these others are promising and looking like 20, 30, 40, you're not going to get the money. And so they're not going to spend the money to reopen it. You know, they'll write off the capital, and it's horrible to write off billions you put in, but your shareholders, investors are not going to give you a few hundred million dollars to open the thing up because they said aluminum prices aren't going anywhere. You're not making a big margin. Governments don't realize how complicated business is. I swear business is more complicated than politics, Alec. And governments don't consider this, that if I'm getting money today, then I'll get it tomorrow. Not necessarily.
That's a very good point you make there about the complexities of business. There's so many moving parts. Whereas if you're a politician and you get to the top of the pile in politics, you just have to be able to schmooze people, the right people, and you'll get voted by them into a senior position. It doesn't work like that in business. You need a far greater depth of insight into almost scientific things. But you're talking about that. I'm really interested to get your take on what's going on with Rio Tinto, because there is a big South African issue here. It's particularly Richards Bay Minerals being put on the block. Effectively, Rio Tinto is saying, come and make us an offer and we'll sell it.
For sure. And we have heard that story in various guises for 20 years. And I believe it. I believe it 20 years ago. Palabora Copper was Rio Tinto's. And when did they start getting out of it? Unfortunately, they started getting out of it when copper finally took off. But maybe that was good for us. You know, had Anglos and Rios, who'd been running Palabora, well, Rio started it. I think Anglos got involved in the 70s or 80s. But those were the halcyon days. I don't even like thinking of those days. The 80s and the 90s, those were just down, down, down metal prices year after year. They'd pop up for maybe 6 months or a year, and then they'd go down again. So when you look at the end of those two decades, when you look at 99, 2000, 2001, Alec, most metals were either at all-time lows, and when Pete Major says all-time, he means 5,000 years. Most of those metals were near all-time lows or the second all-time low, which means hardly anybody was making money. And Rios and Anglos, especially Rios, they kept Palabora going. Now, funny enough, it kept showing a profit and they kept putting in money for CapEx. But by the time the new minerals bill hit out, 2004. And I'm telling you, this is a great analogy. If you grew up when I did and you watched Evel Knievel jump the Snake River Canyon in his steamship, you know, it wasn't really a motorcycle. A mile is too far to jump in a motorcycle. But I saw that. I watched Evel Knievel take off and it would have worked perfect. I think everything went well, except the parachute deployed as he was shooting up the ramp. And we've always heard stories, oh, his foot slipped off the dead man. You know, a dead man meant if he passed out or something, his foot would slip off the pedal, the chute would deploy to try and save him. So he denied, no, my foot did not slip off the dead man. I think it did, or a circuit malfunctioned, whatever. You look at the videos and the pictures, that ship was taking off just as planned, faster than hell. It hadn't even left the ramp, and you could see the chute deploying. So now it's trying to go across the Grand Canyon. It had all the power to. It had the aerodynamics, but the parachute was opening up, holding it back. That is South Africa in 2004. We'd worked and scrimped and saved, ate dog food, lived out in the streets for 20-some years. We'd kept most our minds open, most our minds profitable. And now here comes the great reckoning. Metal prices are taking off across the board. Everything, iron, silver, gold, platinum, diamonds, everything started running in 2003, 2004. And the ANC says, now's the time to deploy the parachute. You know, we don't want our mining sector taking off too much. It might get to the other side. Heaven forbid. And boy, they came out with the MPRDA. They kept adding to it. They kept revising it. So I'm losing track now. But that's what led to the big mining companies saying, we don't see a rosy future here. We see the momentum going in the wrong direction. And it's not a knee-jerk reaction. We saw the momentum starting to change in the late 90s. And boy, now in the new millennium, the ANC is really body slamming this sector. Royalties, BE, critical. Yeah, uranium started to run. So all of a sudden they froze every uranium prospect we had here for 18 months. Oh, it's a critical mineral. So we got no new uranium development. What was the other one that really knocked us for a loop? Was shale gas. Oh my gosh, you know, this is a real critical thing. We didn't even know what it was, and yet now it's critical, right? We froze shale gas exploration for years here, talking about crazy, we want 51%. So yeah, that's led to big companies leaving South Africa. So I'm off the track about Rio, apologies. Major gets off the track real quick if we don't watch it.
Well, it's an interesting, it's such a fascinating area and so unknown to most people. But Richards Bay Minerals has been a, I suppose, a bone of contention for many, many, many years. Rio's never been a comfortable licensee in South Africa. I think they've had that, they've had a rough time around Richards Bay Minerals from the environmentalists for decades now. So to see them with a new management team, the new restructuring that's going on at Rio's, to put that on the block, I suppose we shouldn't be too surprised.
No, we shouldn't be surprised. And Alec, how many mining districts in this country have had the violence that Richards Bay Minerals did? You know, that KwaZulu-Natal area around it, you know, shooting a general manager, shooting some of those top management people there, you know, that is... that's ultra violent. That's raising eyebrows in South Africa. We got to be one of the, what, five most violent countries on the planet out of 200 plus countries. So, you know, it's like the reasons for Rio to want to disinvest there, they keep being added year after year, probably almost month after month. There's just more and more reasons. And now heavy mineral sands prices, they're actually, they're not slumping bad, but they're way down from their peaks. You know, there's just plenty of heavy mineral sands in the world. And sure, that's a great deposit. And what's sad is they got huge infrastructure there. They've been there for over 40 years. And they're really integrated in that part of the country. They're really integrated in the Richards Bay area. So we don't want to even think of the place closing, but if it got much worse, if metal prices go down and the violence hasn't subsided, and the government here, it's got leaded feet. And we've seen how quick a country the size of China and America can turn around policy when they get a leader that has a vision, you know, whether it's the correct one or not. These big countries move pretty quick. Look at Trump in the States. You know, he shows executive power is much more than any president realized before. And Che and China, he's moving fast. These are big established countries that move quick. And yet it's South Africa. Why can't we move quick? You know, why do we have to have a one-way ratchet working against mining? Click, 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 click. Never reverses, you know, for Gwede to say, oh, I'm reversing the BE policy on exploration. Well, we don't spend anything on exploration. So say I'm removing BE and I say, say I'm removing B, even when he takes it out of the legislation. You've still got 9 independent provinces here that still require BE. So, you know, let someone try and stand up to Trump. You see, they're in the headlines and they're going to get removed. But people silently stand up. There's just too many reasons for Rio not to want to stay there. And this whole country should be protesting. We want them to stay. What do we have to do to get them to want to stay and not sell?
I saw an interesting line a couple of interesting lines in the pre-close statement this morning from AFRIMAT. The one was about ferrochrome smelters closing down in South Africa, harming their anthracite business. How bad is it, Peter? How many of these ferrochrome smelters are not there anymore? Because presumably that would also add to the woes, not just of the mining industry, but employment generally.
I don't know offhand. I used to know those figures. Won't take much to find them. I'm guessing we're down to 50% of our ferrochrome smelters from, say, 20 years ago. And I might be. I'm probably overestimating, Alec. It's probably even worse than 50%. Associated Manganese, Samancor, they were the big ones. You know, Glencore, I don't know how many of their smelters are running. You know, maybe they have 66% running what they did. But if you think of the ones that are just plain closed, we are exporting. It's the one mineral I can categorically say we're exporting more than we ever have. And we're mining more than we ever have. And Gwede loves showing that chart. And I guess I would too in his position. You know, he doesn't have a lot of good news charts, but that's kind of a poison good news chart. So yes, we're up to 22 million tons of chrome being produced, and the majority is being exported. And hey, a lot of that came from the PGM producers, because when they went through hard times, they realized we're sitting on these huge dumps. It's very, very fine chrome. But it doesn't take much like desperation or a high price to trigger the ingenuity in people. They figured out how to get that very fine chrome that was a waste product out of the dump. So all of our PGM mines are exporting 1.5-2 million tons a year. You know, big numbers. So they're exporting it, I said. Not just producing it, they are exporting it. And that's putting our ferrochrome producers under pressure. The rising electricity costs, we all know, put them under producer, because that's what you use. Yes, you use anthracite, but anthracite's not your big cost item. Electricity is. And China, they are constantly innovating. So I just think back 20 years ago, yeah, China's trying to break into the ferrochrome industry, but they're inefficient. They got to import it all the way across the ocean. Well, barge rates are so low. Once you get that on the barge, doesn't matter if you go across the river, across the lake, or across the ocean. And China's logistics, you know, the largest port terminals in the world, something like their biggest port is bigger than I think all of America's on the West Coast put together. And I've seen videos of it. And they keep reminding you as you watch the video, notice there's no people. The whole thing's robotically controlled. So China has dropped the cost of ferrochrome smelting. We've raised the cost of ferrochrome smelting. So I really battle to think, how do our guys even keep competitive here? But the future is pretty gray. Unless we come up with low-cost electricity, unless we can lower our costs of getting the material to the smelters, yeah, they're going to use less and less anthracite. And poor AFRIMAT, huh? Iron ore price goes down, and making it even worse, 50% of their production was going to ISCOR, that's almost closing down. So they're getting hit with triple whammies here, you know, falling demand for anthracite, falling price for anthracite, falling demand for iron ore, falling price for iron ore. Oh, and a strengthening rand. So that's getting clubbed by 5 people at one time.
As far as iron ore is concerned and moving to Australia, Fortescue came out with its results, and it's It was down very sharply on iron ore. Is that going to tell us something about South Africa's Kumba or maybe other iron ore producers?
Without a doubt, yes. Exxaro had an amazing set of results, exceeding expectations. And I get scared when companies exceed expectations because it's pretty easy to analyze where a company gets its money from. You know, listed companies are so open. I always wondered why governments make it so difficult and expensive and time-consuming for listed companies, because once they delist, they don't list again. And boy, then you can't follow anything. So Exxaro had good results, but the fact is their underlying earnings are coming from coal, and coal is continuing down. I see it. RB1 is now $86. Well, we were so used to coal being above $100 for years here. Now it's down to 86. The Rand is 1760. Iron ore, it's hanging in there at 102. But geez, we're used to 130 iron ore. So yeah, Fortescue, that is a harbinger of results to come. And that's why Anglos and Billiton are as low as they are, look as cheap as they are, because the markets don't know how they're going to increase earnings on iron ore. Even if they increase production, can they increase production to compensate for the fall in revenue that they're going to get from these prices?
And the good news remains on the gold front, where Goldfields Limited's results were, well, I suppose, as expected, spectacular.
When they went through hard times
running.
They were. I've seen a few comments. Look, they really exceeded what I thought. I'm kind of negative on gold producers because extended periods of high prices always led to extended, overextended cost increases. But the producers have held costs amazingly well compared to previous runs. And this has been an unbelievable run in the gold price. So we've only had a run like this on the gold price once. That was in the 70s. And the thing is, when it went up in the 70s, it came down quicker than it went up. This is different, Alec. This is like no gold run in the history of man. This thing's extended. You can see this price falls from 3,400 ounce down to, doesn't even get to 3,300. You know, what's that, a 3% fall? And the demand just powers in there. So, and yet the gold producers are holding costs better than I can remember. And Goldfields, I give them credit. They had surprisingly good cost control. Look, it's coming. Although I saw today the headlines is Newmont's going to retrench workers. And my first question was, no, this sounds insane. And then my second thought was, is that because Natasha's there? You know, she got promoted. Is she trying to show how tough she is in a man's world? And then my third thought was kind of sarcastic. Hey, everybody I've been talking to in the States tells me how bloated that Newmont head office is. Maybe those are the workers that are being retrenched. And boy, do you hear how, I don't want to say non-productive people. You know, people in executive positions, they do try hard. But are they adding value? You know, are they lowering the cost of production? There are so many departments in these gold mines that didn't exist not even a decade or two ago, compared to if you'd gone in the head office of Rand Mines, Anglo Gold, GFSA, JCI, you know, back in the 70s and 80s. Look at the head office there. Boy, everybody was attributable to gold production. Now you go in these head offices, geez, the production department's probably a quarter of the head office. Anyways, yeah, those are good results by Goldfields. The fact that they've made progress resolving things with the Ghanaian government, that's great news. The cost increases are coming, but these three-year contracts we saw signed earlier, and I thought there was even a four-year, you know, that was great. It locked in so that couldn't just erupt and go to double digits. You know, it locked it into stable. They were single-digit increases. They were a couple percent over inflation. People were not getting screwed over, but it led to stability. And that retains jobs. I can't believe Newmont is retrenching many workers. They might be retrenching some executives or some employees, but there's a big difference between just an employee and a miner.
And help us understand why the gold price is on this incredible tear.
Demand. Broader demand than we've ever seen. Broader demand from the central banks than we have ever seen. And remember, the central bank buying in the 70s, how different the world is today. You know, did China even have a central bank in the 70s? Oh boy, they got a central bank now. It's as big as the American central bank. Now, the American central bank isn't buying gold, but the Chinese central bank is. And I think there was a graph that David Melville sent out this morning. You probably saw it, Alec. It shows gold is now the second largest foreign exchange holding in the world's central banks. 20% is gold. Remember the Swiss always used to recommend, or supposedly the Swiss recommended you have 5%, you know, in case there's a revolution and you got to get out of town quick. Well, now central bank holdings, 20% of gold. It's, was it 40% in dollars? I didn't even look at the others. But yeah, it is massive, constant central bank buying. The central banks are larger than ever. They're more aggressive than ever. And we just hear the populace. We know the populace in America is buying like they haven't bought since the 70s. Now I hear the populace in China, 1.4 billion people is buying. And that's a free country. And those people have spending power. You know, China is so different. So there's not many comparisons we can do with the 70s that hold water here.
Okay. So we've spoken about lots of different areas. Is there any bright point? Is there anywhere where the Peter Major fan club can go and have a little nibble on a stock or a metal that is popping out for you right now?
Damn, that's a tough question. And that is a very appropriate question. You know, I was a man who had opinions and views on all kinds of mining shares in the 90s. And a lot of it was because there was big hope in the 90s. We had a new government, sanctions were dropping, we were allowed to trade with the world. And even more important in my little world, Alec, in the 1990s, we still had 130 listed mining companies on the JSE. Even more impressive, I think 95% of them were still paying a dividend. People don't realize how impressive that was. That the 90s saw close to the lowest prices in most commodities in the world, and South African shares were still paying dividends. And you could buy almost any South African mining share at a single digit P, you know, maybe 10, 11, 12 PE. So it was easy and it was fun recommending all kinds of deals. Now, it's hard. And yeah, there's more companies than ever, and that scares me. I'm always afraid of new companies. New companies, they take a lot of time to analyze, a lot of time to get confidence with. You know, it's new management, new terrain, new area, and there's so much hype and a lot of BS. You know, the majority of these new companies are just riding the bandwagon. So if I look at established companies, I could throw you a lot literally a month ago, including gold companies. This is the difference from the 90s till now, Alec. In the 80s and 90s, the world still thought gold was going to take off tomorrow and most other commodities with it. We had no idea we were in a 22-year bear turn. So all our analysis in the days of Alan Gray, Coronation, Seyfritz, we could determine, just like our compatriots in the States, most of these mining companies, they were leading the commodity price by 12 to 18 months. That's what they were. The share price, the horizon it was looking at was a minimum of 12 months to 18 months. I don't know what it is now, but I'm telling you, these gold shares are lagging the gold price now. Now, are they lagging it by a month or 3 months? But all this year, our gold shares I'm not just saying South Africans. I'm saying all gold shares have been lagging the price. Newmont and Barrick, at the time of your big conference in March, I was showing prices of Newmont and Barrick that were the same price 10, 20, and 30 years ago. And that's in nominal terms. And yet the gold price during your conference, it was doing great. So the whole world has gone from forecasting higher metal prices. It kept forecasting like Peter Major was here this year. No, this gold's too high. It's going to come off. But the last 30 days, it is corrected. You've probably just seen Anglo's went from 800 to 1,050 a share. Goldfields went from, I don't even know, was it 350 to 570? It's like a coiled spring. Now these gold shares, they're discounting, I believe, a higher price than we currently see. So had you even asked me that question 5 weeks ago, I would have been confident enough to give you three or four big, well-named gold companies. But now I'm scared of them all. Now, to me, they've corrected, Alec. I don't know when I've seen this rapid a correction, and I'm not sure what's triggered it, because the gold price has been flat since April. You know, it's trading between 3,300 and 3,400. You got to put a freaking heart rate monitor to even see if it's alive. It's just oscillating that tight little range. But boy, these shares have just rocketed. So
we carried a piece in BizNews Premium this week from our partners at the Financial Times, which showed how the gold shares suddenly are outperforming the gold price. And thanks for putting that in perspective. I'm going to close off with a new listing. Today, there was a new listing on the JSE, a company called ASP Isotopes. It's already listed on the NASDAQ. It bought or is buying Renergen, which is a company that the punters just loved. They didn't like the management very much because the management never seemed to be able to deliver. The guy who runs ASP Isotopes is an investment analyst. He's had a lot of time in New York. He's a chemical engineer from Oxford. So he seems to know what's going on. And certainly the underlying business is interesting. Have you had a chance to look at it? Is it the kind of stock that you would ever consider owning?
Every time I read about it, I like it. The negative I had was the CEO was not living in the country, and I know about long-distance management. And I don't care what his excuse is, whether it's valid or not, living out of the country when your project is there. And I'm a real old mining man. You know, I believe the Anglo-American and the South African gold model. You had the general manager, the AGM, the underground manager. They all lived around the headframe, you know, so you had instantaneous news flow, instantaneous action, whatever needed to be done. I like the idea. Robert Friedland, owned 10% of the company, you know, for Friedland to put money in there. He's got a good team. They analyze the hell out of it. I can't put my finger on what happened there. I don't know how much we can blame the South African government on this one. I didn't read anything other than some property that Gwede said he wasn't going to let him keep. And they said, oh, that was vital. They had a huge area. Alec, I don't know. Man, that's got to be harder to analyze than any of these mining companies, certainly for me. It just always looks like a buy to me. It always looks like I want to take part on it. You know, they just had so many reasons that they could increase the helium production. The helium price was a real critical mineral. And I don't want to buy a company because it's going to get help from the government. You know, that was Mark Shuttleworth's big, big demand, that we invest in nothing that depends on the government for any special help, let alone financial. But hey, that would help it a lot. And there's more reasons for this government to help it than not to help it. There's more reasons for the U.S. government to take an active interest in this. You know, helium is critical for a lot of things. Would I buy it? I'd have to look at a graph. You know, technical charts give you an indication if something is overpriced or underpriced. Doesn't mean it won't get cheaper or more expensive, but when things are trading below a standard deviation, up or down, it warrants a look. And I haven't looked at this. I'm guessing it's still trading about a standard deviation down, but I'm positive on it. You know, all the fundamentals that we read about it, they can't all be wrong. Half of them can't even be wrong. It's kind of a broad answer. I hope it comes right, and I'd be tempted to buy a little.
And go and do your homework on ASP Isotopes, the new owner of Renergen. Peter Major is with Modern Corporate Solutions. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com, and we'll be back with the Mining Web Weekly next week.